This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in تخفوا ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض وَاللَّهُ عَلَى كُلِّ شَيْءٍ قَدِيرٌ يَوْمَ تَجِدُ كُلُّ نَفْسٍ مَا عَمِلَتْ مِنْ خَيْرٍ مُحْضَرًا وما عملت من سوء تود لو أن بينها وبينه أمدا بعيدا ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف بالعباد صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top stories: Iran holds a ceremony to launch the clinical trial of its second domestically made coronavirus vaccine. Iran tells the UN that Israel has recently intensified its provocative remarks against Tehran, saying it will give a firm response to any military adventurism. Yemen's Ansarullah movement says the credibility of the U.S. move to delist the group as a designated terror organization will only be assessed when Saudi Arabia ends its war on Yemen. Welcome to the program. Iranian medical experts have begun the clinical trial of another indigenously developed coronavirus vaccine. Covaparse is an inhalable vaccine developed using biotechnology. The tests of the vaccine have already been conducted successfully on animals, including guinea pigs, hamsters, and monkeys. The Covaparse vaccine has been developed by the Razi Institute, which is one of the most important medical research centers in West Asia. A launch of its human trial was announced in a ceremony in Tehran attended by experts and officials. Addressing the gathering, Health Minister Saeed Namaki said the achievement is a source of national pride for Iran.
One of the major jobs done over the past few months was to rely on domestically developed technology to produce a vaccine. The COVID-19 vaccine is not a simple one to develop. As the COVID-19 virus is a complex one, producing a vaccine for it is a very complex process.
Minister added, it is not clear how effective the coronaries vaccines developed by different countries are, but they are the only way available to help contain the disease. Iran has developed another COVID-19 vaccine called Coviran, which is under the first human trial phase. Volunteers who received the shot had no symptoms such as shock or fever after the injection. Well, COVID-19 clusters on U.S. military bases in South Korea are raising alarm with the country's public and activists. Many worry the virus is being spread from U.S. service members to the general South Korean population. From South Korea, we have Frank Smith reporting.
U.S. military personnel deploying from the American mainland to bases abroad are bringing COVID-19 with them. In South Korea, more than 700 United States Forces Korea members have tested positive for the virus, raising alarms in South Korea.
Since Americans value individual freedom and personal liberty, they have tendencies to not adhere to South Korean quarantine guidelines. Therefore, in the case of Pyeongtaek, living with the U.S. military, there's a high risk of exposure to coronavirus.
U.S. Forces Korea soldiers have repeatedly flouted local COVID-19 precautions, including holding a large maskless party. In January, U.S. bases here issued shelter-in-place orders because of COVID-19 cluster outbreaks.
The U.S. Forces Korea Camp Humphreys said in a February 1st press release that less than 1% of its active duty troops had tested positive for COVID-19. If we compare that to how South Korea is dealing with the virus, it's 10 times more likely for a U.S. soldier on a military base here to have COVID-19 than someone in the general South Korean population.
U.S. forces here have begun administering the vaccine, although new cases continue to arrive on almost a daily basis.
It seems that it is necessary to thoroughly manage corona-confirmed patients for testing before entering Korea, and more thorough management measures should be implemented not only for the U.S. military, but also for South Korean employees on the U.S. base who have a lot of contact with people.
Meanwhile, South Korea continues to experience hundreds of new cases each day, with the rollout of a vaccine set to begin here this month. Frank Smith, Pyeongtaek, South Korea.
COVID-19 crisis deepens in the Americas region despite efforts to contain the virus and its variants through vaccination and restrictive measures. Nearly 462,000 Americans have died since the first fatality was reported nearly a year ago. On Friday, the U.S. set a new record in daily fatalities with more than 5,000 deaths. Meanwhile, the country's confirmed cases are approaching 27 million. Despite attempts to curb the surge in coronavirus figures, the United States remains the world's worst-hit nation by the pandemic in terms of both cases as well as deaths. In Brazil now, coronavirus deaths have surpassed 231,000, the second highest death toll in the world. Officials registered some 1,000 new fatalities on Saturday. They also recorded over 50,000 cases of the virus, raising the total to nearly 9.5 million. In other news, Iran's ambassador to the UN has warned that Tehran will give a firm response to any Israeli military adventurism. Majid Taht Ravanchi issued the warning in a letter to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and the President of the Security Council. Taht Ravanchi said Israel has recently intensified its provocative and hawkish remarks against Iran and is planning to carry out its hostile threats. He described such threats as a blatant violation of the UN Charter. Iranian envoy demanded an international response to, quote, Israel's destabilizing policies in the region. In January, Israel's Army Chief of Staff warned the U.S. against rejoining the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Aviv Kochavi said he had ordered his forces to gear up for possible offensive against Iran. Well, Iran says a newly declared U.S. decision to end its military support for the Saudi-led war coalition is not enough to end the six-year war on Yemen. The Iranian Foreign Ministry said the Saudi-led air, sea, and land blockade of Yemen and attacks on the country must end as well. The ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, said ending support for and not selling weapons to Riyadh can be a step towards correcting past mistakes. Khatibzadeh expressed hope that, quote, warmongering states realize their strategic mistake in invading Yemen and admit to their mistake. On Thursday, U.S. President Joe Biden announced that Washington will terminate all offensive support to Saudi Arabia in the Yemen conflict, including related arms sales to Riyadh. Political commentator Brian Terrell says perpetrators of the Yemen war should be brought to justice and that the U.S. needs to end its airstrikes on the country.
the blockade will continue. There has to be something more. A year ago, the United Nations group of eminent experts on Yemen suggested that the situation be turned over to the criminal court. And it's not the International Criminal Court. And it simply is not enough for one of the suppliers to perhaps cut back on the weapons. And we don't know how that's even going to turn out. There needs to be, you know, crimes have been committed, and reparations have to be paid for the United States. Simply to say that it's going to stop the relevant arms sales to Saudi Arabia is not enough. There's also been, since 2002, the United States has had its own war in Yemen against Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. This has been very destabilizing for Yemen, and unfortunately this war that the United States war in Yemen is not even being addressed by this.
Yemen's Ansarullah movement has welcomed the U.S. decision to delist the group as a designated terror organization. An advisor to Yemen's head of the Supreme Political Council said the new U.S. administration got off to a good start and took an advanced step toward peace. He, however, noted that the credibility of Washington's steps will only be assessed when the Saudi-led war ends and the siege is lifted. Member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mohammed Ali Houthi, also said his country is ready for both war and peace. This comes after Washington said Congress has been formally notified of State Secretary Antony Blinken's intent to reverse the terrorist designation of Ansarullah. Former President Donald Trump, as you know, blacklisted the Yemeni movement only days before leaving office. Political commentator Judith Bellow says it is a fact that the primary force behind Yemen's blockade is the United States.
We should applaud the government, especially for delisting the Houthis from the list of terrorist organizations, and we should applaud them restraining the weapons sales as well. However, as Brian said, we need to have something more. We have to have more from our government than they've offered. The United States is a primary force in the blockade on Yemen. It's not a secondary force. They're not helping anyone. Our European allies are helping us to maintain that blockade. And the every bit of aid that gets into Yemen is directed through the United States base on Djibouti, which is just across the straits from Yemen. So the United States needs to do more than talk about what they're going to do to other people. But there's an issue right now that the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates, and I'm not quite sure what they mean by when they say the Saudi coalition, because the United Arab Emirates and the Saudis are in competition in Yemen. And they are looking to divide Yemen between them.
Palestinian leadership has welcomed a decision by the International Criminal Court clearing the way for its chief prosecutor to open a war crimes probe into Israeli military actions committed on the Palestinian territories. Mona Kandil is in West Bank.
The Palestinian leadership has praised the International Criminal Court for its ruling that it has jurisdiction in the Palestinian territories, allowing its chief prosecutor, Fatou Ben Souda, to investigate Israeli atrocities, despite fierce objections from Tel Aviv. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Ishtayi said the decision is a victory for justice, humanity, and freedom, and for the blood of the victims, namely the Palestinians and their families. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also praised the ruling and said it's ready to cooperate with the ICC's prosecutor if an investigation is launched.
We urge the International Court and its chief prosecutor to immediately launch an investigation into Israeli war crimes against the Palestinian people. We have already filed several legal complaints against Israel with the ICC. We are now ready to carry out every possible effort to see Israeli military officials and settlers being prosecuted for their crimes.
The ICC's ruling, however, has angered the Israeli regime, as its Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, dismissed the ruling as a political tribunal, accusing the ICC for being a political body and not a legal institution. Israel has not joined the International Criminal Court, but the Palestinian Authority is a signatory since 2015. This means the ICC's mandate is to prosecute people, not countries, including those from states that are not signatories, and in this case, Israeli leaders, military officials, and soldiers who are accused of carrying out crimes against Palestinians.
I doubt that that will make such a difference in Israel, because if we know the nature of Israel, and it's based on violence, based on the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people and grabbing the land of Palestine, because of that, I don't think that will make a big difference for the Israeli policies in the region.
The Palestinians have asked the court to look into Israeli crimes during its 2014 war against Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip, as well as Israel's construction of illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. The ICC's decision paves the way for the tribunal's prosecutor to open a war crime investigation. But the main question lingering in mind is that will the U.S., which has furiously condemned the court, allow prosecution of Israeli officials and forces over their crimes committed in the Palestinian territories? Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Author and researcher Christoph Oberlin has hailed the ICC decision to investigate Israeli war crimes against Palestinians. Oberlin, who wrote a book entitled Path to Court to Israeli Leaders Before the International Criminal Court, says the decision opens a window to bring the perpetrators to justice. Take a listen, please.
The ICC, the sanctions, are directed to the responsibles. And the responsible are not only the soldiers if there is a war crime. And everybody has to know that the real responsible are the people who are planning. And so that doesn't prevent the political responsible. They are the first responsible. That means that the Prime Minister Netanyahu, for instance, is responsible for the victims of the March of Return or the war of 2014. Israel is not a member of the ICC. That doesn't prevent Israel to be condemned or to be investigated. You never ask to a criminal to recognize the court. It is absolutely stupid to say that. They have to receive proofs. Exactly like there is a murder, you have to be absolutely sure who is the killer, who has killed the people, how he did it, and so on. So you have different files. The file about the March of Return, you have now the ICC received a few months ago 2,400 private complaints of persons, victims, or family of victims. And for each complaint, they have the chain of proof with the video, with the autopsy, with the witness of the crime and everything, the report of the doctors, and the identity of the witness. Everything has been translated into English, so it has been a lot of work. And in fact, there is a very professional team in Gaza working. Just they start to work after the war 2014, because the authorities became conscious that it was absolutely necessary to bring directly to the ICC the chain of proof. Because it is absolutely sure that Israel will block the investigators, the policers, or the police of the ICC to investigate on the field.
Several Palestinian rights groups have praised the International Criminal Court for its decision to launch an investigation into Israeli war crimes in the occupied territories. In a joint statement, the groups, including Al-Haq Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, called the ICC ruling a landmark decision. They stressed that immediate action must be taken by the court in order to ensure justice and accountability for Palestinian victims. The ICC ruling says it has jurisdiction to investigate the situation in the Palestinian territories occupied by Israel in 1967, namely the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. including East Jerusalem al-Quds. The Israeli Prime Minister has rejected the ruling, calling it pure anti-Semitism. The first mass burial of Izadi Kurds killed by Daesh terrorists in the northern Iraqi town of Sinjar 7 years ago has been held in a local village. Amid tight security, relatives of the victims carried more than 100 coffins during the burial ceremony attended by official delegations and civil society organizations. Back in 2014, more than 3,000 Izadis were killed and nearly 7,000 Yazidi women and girls were abducted and sexually abused by Daesh in northern Iraq. The UN denounced the onslaught as genocide. The first exhumations of mass graves began in March of 2019, led by a UN investigative team in collaboration with the Iraqi government. More than 80 mass graves have been discovered in the area. 19 of them have been dug up so far.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
جانم تپشم سخنم باشد وطنم وطنم ای خان که گوهر خیز بهره وطنم قدمم عشقم سخنم قسمم از عاشقی لبریز.
Congratulations on the victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The Limelight.
The U.S. war machine has become a bull in the global China shop, wielding purely destructive power to destabilize countries and wreck their economies. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Media Benjamin and Nicholas J.S. Davis. This article is published under the heading, The Decline and Fall of the American Empire. Stay tuned for the details, please. In 2004, journalist Ron Susskind quoted a Bush White House advisor, reportedly Karl Rove, as boasting, "We are an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality." He dismissed Susskind's assumption that public policy must be rooted in the reality-based community. "We are history actors," the advisor told him, "and you, all of you, will be left to just study what we do." 16 years later, the American wars and war crimes launched by the Bush administration have only spread chaos and violence far and wide. And this historic conjunction of criminality and failure has predictably undermined America's international power and authority. Back in the imperial heartland, the political marketing industry that Roof and his colleagues were part of has had more success dividing and ruling the hearts and minds of Americans than of Iraqis, Russians, or Chinese. The irony of the Bush administration's imperial pretensions was that America has been an empire from its very founding, and that a White House staffer's political use of the term empire in 2004 was not emblematic of a new and rising empire, as he claimed, but of a decadent, declining empire stumbling blindly into an agonizing death spiral. Americans were not always so ignorant of the imperial nature of their country's ambitions. George Washington described New York as the seat of an empire, and his military campaign against British forces there as the pathway to empire. New Yorkers eagerly embraced their state's identity as the Empire State, which is still enshrined in the Empire State Building and on New York State license plates. The expansion of America's territorial sovereignty over Native American lands, the Louisiana Purchase, and the annexation of northern Mexico in the Mexican-American War built an empire
that far outstripped the one that George Washington built. But that imperial expansion was more controversial than most Americans realize. 14 out of 52 U.S. senators voted against the 1848 treaty to annex most of Mexico, without which Americans might still be visiting California, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Nevada, Utah, and most of Colorado as exotic Mexican travel spots. In the full flowering of the American Empire after the Second World War, its leaders understood the skill and subtlety required to exercise imperial power in a post-colonial world. No country fighting for independence from the UK or France was going to welcome imperial invaders from America. So America's leaders developed a system of neo-colonialism through which they exercised overarching imperial sovereignty over much of the world, while avoiding terms like empire or imperialism that would undermine their post-colonial credentials. It was left to critics like President Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana to seriously examine the imperial control that wealthy countries still exercise over nominally independent post-colonial countries like this. In his book, Neo-Colonialism, The Last Stage of Imperialism, Nkrumah condemned neo-colonialism as the worst form of imperialism. For those who practice it, he wrote, it means power without responsibility. And for those who suffer from it, it means exploitation without redress. So post-World War II, Americans grew up in carefully crafted ignorance of the very fact of American empire. And the myths, when to disguise it, provide fertile soil for today's political divisions and disintegration. Trump's Make America Great Again and Biden's promise to restore American leadership are both appeals to nostalgia for the fruits of American empire. Past blame games over who lost China or Vietnam or Cuba have come home to roost in an argument over who lost America and who can somehow restore its mythical former greatness or leadership. Even as America leads the world in allowing a pandemic to ravage its people and economy, neither party's leaders are ready for a more realistic debate over how to redefine and rebuild America as a post-imperial nation in today's multipolar world. Every successful empire has expanded, ruled, and exploited its far-flung territories through a combination of economic and military power. Even in the American Empire's neocolonial phase, the role of the U.S. military and the CIA was to kick open doors through which American businessmen could follow the flag to set up shop and develop new markets. But now, U.S. militarism and America's economic interests have diverged. Apart from a few military contractors, American businesses have not followed the flag into the ruins of Iraq or America's other current war zones in any lasting way. 18 years after the U.S. invasion, Iraq's largest trading partner is China. Instead of opening doors for American big business or supporting America's diplomatic position in the world, the U.S. war machine has become a bull in the global China shop, wielding purely destructive power to destabilize countries and wreck their economies, closing doors to economic opportunity instead of opening them, diverting resources from real needs at home and damaging America's international standing instead of enhancing it. When President Eisenhower warned against the unwarranted influence of America's military-industrial complex, he was predicting precisely this kind of dangerous dichotomy between the real economic and social needs of the American people
and a war machine that costs more than the next 10 militaries in the world put together, but cannot win a war or vanquish a virus, let alone reconquer a lost empire. China and the EU have become the major trading partners of most countries in the world. The United States is still a regional economic power, but even in the South America, most countries now trade more with China. America's militarism has accelerated these trends by squandering resources on weapons and wars. While China and the EU have invested in peaceful economic development and the 21st century infrastructure. For example, China has built the largest high-speed rail network in the world in just 10 years, and Europe has been building and expanding its high-speed network since 1990s. But high-speed rail is still only on the drawing board in America. China has lifted 800 million people out of poverty, while America's poverty rate has barely budged in 50 years, and child poverty has increased. America still has the weakest social safety net of any developed country, and no universal healthcare system. And the inequalities of wealth and power caused by extreme neoliberalism have left half of Americans with little or no savings to live on in retirement or to weather any disruption in their lives. American leaders' insistence on siphoning off 66% of U.S. federal discretionary spending to preserve and expand a war machine that has long outlived any useful role in America's declining economic empire is a debilitating waste of resources that jeopardizes American people's future. Decades ago, Martin Luther King Jr. warned Americans that a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. As U.S. government debates whether they can afford COVID relief, a Green New Deal, and universal health care, Americans would be wise to recognize that their only hope of transmitting this decadent, declining empire into dynamic and prosperous post-imperial nation is to rapidly and profoundly shift their national priorities from irrelevant, destructive militarism to the programs of social uplift that Dr. King called for.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Joe Biden has been inaugurated as the 46th President of the United States. Several of his cabinet appointees have also been confirmed by the Senate. So what have we learned so far from these confirmation hearings and his latest executive actions regarding both his domestic and foreign policy? Let's take a closer look. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Roughly 1 year ago, Joe Biden's candidacy looked miserable and dead in the water. He was struggling to raise money for his presidential campaign from small-dollar donations and had even tapped out all his wealthy Wall Street donors. His hopes of getting to the White House didn't look very promising at all. And yet here we are 1 year later, and Joe Biden has managed by some miracle to be elected the 46th president. We heard over and over warnings from the mainstream media and politicians alike how a progressive like Bernie Sanders just wasn't going to cut it against an existential threat like Donald Trump, and that it was imperative to get someone more moderate like Joe Biden into office, and that as soon as he got into the White House, everything would be fine. So now that he's the president, what has his first week in office looked like? Well, the mainstream media wasted no time celebrating. In fact, the entire day of his inauguration was spent celebrating Trump's departure by salivating over Joe Biden and even expressing joy over former Presidents Bush, Obama, and Clinton, who were also in attendance. This hysteria in the media manifested itself with several reporters referring to this reunion of war criminals as some sort of superhero event.
The sight of the Clintons and the Bushes and the Obamas, you know, the Avengers, you know, sort of the Marvel superheroes back up there together all in one place.
It's frankly amazing how quickly the media forgets that these are the same presidents who started the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, and ruined the lives of millions of people. After this performance was finally over, the first thing Biden did as president was sign a slew of executive orders. Among them, rejoining the Paris Climate Accords, as well as the World Health Organization, which Trump had pulled out of. He reversed a few other decisions made by Trump, like the controversial Muslim ban that Trump introduced in 2017. However, what the media doesn't tell you is that this original law was crafted under Obama's presidency when Joe Biden was vice president. The Visa Waiver Program Improvement and Terrorist Travel Prevention Act of 2015. This is the framework that was introduced by the Obama administration, listing countries like Iran, Syria, Iraq, Sudan as areas of concern and safe havens for terrorists, and placing hurdles for anyone who's visited these countries. Trump, of course, built on that to ban dual nationals entirely, which Biden did roll back, but he hasn't gotten rid of the original legislation from 2015, which singles out these very same countries. Now, absent among any of Biden's first moves are the $2,000 stimulus checks. We heard repeatedly throughout his presidential campaign and from Democratic candidates and politicians that as soon as Biden is elected, Americans will get $2,000 stimulus checks.
We will be able to pass $2,000 stimulus checks for the people next week.
If you send John and the Reverend to Washington, those $2,000 checks will go out the door, restoring hope and decency and honor for so many people who are struggling right now.
Well, those checks still haven't arrived. As a matter of fact, Joe Biden has tried knocking them down to $1,400, claiming that the $600 issued under Trump a few months ago is to be counted as a part of that. It's frankly mind-boggling to see the president of the richest country in the world rob his own citizens in such a way during both the pandemic and economic crisis. And even then, those checks are still no closer to being sent out or anywhere near enough and not retroactive. Now, in terms of healthcare, throughout his campaign, again, Joe Biden would say that healthcare is a human right. And keep in mind, we have millions of Americans that are unemployed, so they've also lost their health insurance as a result of that. Now, Joe Biden isn't saying that healthcare is a human right anymore. He's saying he wants to give Americans easier access to healthcare. Joe Biden has signed two executive actions, reopening enrollment for the Affordable Care Act until May. This is, again, a largely performative gesture and does not guarantee health care. Even if one were to sign up for the Affordable Care Act, most Americans can't afford the deductibles or out-of-pocket payments required for the insurance to kick in, making this effectively useless and leaving millions of Americans still underinsured. Biden's campaign promise to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour also seems to be out the window, with Democrats now introducing legislation aiming to push for this in the year 2025. Keep in mind, the Democrats control the House, the Senate, and the White House, and this is the best they can do? It's frankly shameful, and will leave a large portion of the working class in a dismal state with growing resentment towards Washington. Once again, we're seeing the same behavior during the Obama years when Democrats had a supermajority and refused to do anything of substance with it. Now, in terms of foreign policy, we've had some interesting developments. As expected, Joe Biden's appointee for Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, was approved by the Senate and is now the first black man to ever lead the Pentagon. Austin is another familiar face from the Obama era, serving as the head of U.S. Central Command, which oversaw things like the intervention in Syria and the occupation of Iraq. Another part of his resume that the media seems to gloss over so often is the fact that Austin sat on the board of weapons manufacturer Raytheon, which is one of the largest contractors to the U.S. military. This conflict of interest didn't seem to matter to the Senate, which overwhelmingly voted to approve him, 93-2. Once again, bipartisanship in all things war and empire. Biden's nominee for Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, had his confirmation hearing in the Senate. During a four-hour session, he was asked about a wide array of topics covering China, Venezuela, Iran, and more. Blinken, who served under Obama as Deputy Secretary of State and supported the regime change conquests in Libya and Syria, was grilled by Senator Rand Paul over his support for these failed imperialist endeavors.
Why do the wars continue? Why do the wars in Syria and Libya and Somalia and Afghanistan continue? Because the more things change, the more they stay the same. Mr. Blinken has been a full-throated advocate of military intervention in the Middle East.
Safe to say, when Joe Biden claims diversity and the media class and political class are breathing a sigh of relief, claiming a return to normalcy, their meaning of normal constitutes the same failed policies that resulted in the displacement and the deaths of countless innocents. That's what it really comes down to. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me to talk more is Rania Khalik, journalist and producer of Soapbox and Unauthorized Disclosure. It's great to have you on, Rania. Thanks for taking the time.
It's great to be on with you. Thanks for inviting me, Richard.
So Joe Biden is now president. He's been inaugurated. On his first day, he signs a bunch of executive orders, and he rejoins the Paris Climate Accords, the World Health Organization. So he reverses some of Trump's policies. Do you think he could have done more, however, especially for the working class in the United States?
100%. I mean, what he should have done is he should have come into office, and the first thing he should have done was immediately get out relief checks for people. That should have been his first priority. Was right away, and that's, he campaigned on that. A week before he was elected, he was saying, it's on video, get us elected, get the Democrats, get us in the Senate in Georgia, and we're going to get you $2,000 checks. Democrats were campaigning on that issue. And now, you know, we're back to negotiating maybe $1,400, maybe we'll have it by March. And I was expecting this. You know, Biden is your kind of typical centrist right-wing Democrat. He is doing exactly what Democrats do, which is the very, very least. The very, very least they can get away with. And, you know, there are some, of course, some good things that we should be happy about. Like, of course, he overturned some of Trump's more draconian policies with regard to, for example, the Muslim ban. But, you know, he was also applauded for ending private prisons. Well, he didn't actually end private prisons. He signed an executive order that ended Justice Department contracts with private prisons, but also that's just a reversion to what happened under Obama. So it was just undoing something that Trump had done. You know, I think one of the more alarming aspects of his incoming administration on the domestic front has been really trying to ramp up fear around this new domestic war on terror. And trying to get support for the idea of more anti-terrorism legislation, which we don't need in the U.S. I mean, we already have enough laws on the books in the U.S. to put all of us in jail for thinking the wrong things at this point after 20 years of this endless war on terror. The last thing we need is more laws like that. There's already plenty of laws on the books to deal with what we have known for more than a decade now is one of the biggest threats in America, which is the rise of the far right violence, The U.S. is in an economic crisis right now. People are facing economic ruin. The COVID virus is still completely out of control. And obviously, he's only been in office for like a week or so. But still, I mean, there should be way more measures being taken to try and help people. Or you know what? They're going to have way more riots in the streets, you know, after a few more months or another year of this.
I'm sure you enjoyed the confirmation hearing of Austin Lloyd, who's now the first black Secretary of Defense, or Secretary of State Blinken. What did you make of those? Because, you know, in terms of policy, it's not really that diverse. These are the same people who support a regime change and intervention in Syria and Libya, and they're given job promotions and cabinet positions, and they're rewarded for supporting these horrible policies under Obama.
Well, you know, in order to qualify for being a part of the foreign policy establishment in the U.S., you have to support all those wars. I mean, if you watch this confirmation hearing, actually, I know you did because you were commenting on it yourself. I mean, it was just like it wasn't even a question and answer session. It was like an interrogation by the neocons who run foreign policy in Washington, D.C., some of the most belligerent ones. He had to sit there and basically submit to and bow down to the most warmongering stances proposed by Lindsey Graham. And he was happy to, because he actually agrees with those people. It's not like he was really pretending. He actually agrees with the things that he said. I mean, he was pro-regime change, pro-recognizing Juan Guaido, pro-sanctions on Venezuela that are killing 40,000 people a year. You know, he was pro-ramping up the Cold War with China. He was, you know, he repeatedly bragged about his support for arming the right-wing neo-Nazis in Ukraine, though that's not how he says it. I mean, the list goes on, one thing after another. And, you know, even on Iran, I will say that's probably the one point of difference between a Biden administration and a Trump administration that's quite drastic, is the desire to go back to the Iran nuclear deal, mostly because people like Anthony Blinken were involved with helping negotiate it. So it's like near and dear to their hearts. They have like an emotional attachment to it. But at the same time, when it comes to Iran, even though that's a difference between them, at the same time, the same underlying narrative about Iran remains the same between these two parties. Mike Pompeo and Anthony Blinken are very difficult to tell apart when they're actually talking about Iran, because they say these same exact things.
Right. I saw Blinken's first press briefing, and he essentially said that he wants Iran to take the first step towards the JCPOA. I'm confused by that, because the United States is the one who left the deal. Shouldn't the U.S. be the first to show some goodwill, some good faith in re-entering the deal first?
Well, that would be logical, right? And that's what's funny, is you see these pronouncements coming out of the Biden administration about how, yeah, Iran has to go back to the deal first. And it's like, you're the one who broke the deal. Like, it was you, the Trump administration. Okay, not only did they break the deal, they over and over and over repeatedly committed acts of aggression and provocations for war. They killed Iran's top general on foreign soil. That's unprecedented. Like, you don't do that. They broke, I mean, the U.S. behaved like a rogue state completely. And the sanctions, I mean, if some more powerful country came along and implemented sanctions on the U.S. the way the U.S. has implemented on Iran, the U.S. would nuke them. Because that's an act of war. Putting a country under economic siege like that is an act of war. So it's completely outrageous for anybody in the Biden administration to think they have the upper hand morally whatsoever, or are in any kind of position to be telling Iran that you're the one who has to make concessions first.
We're seeing that Robert Malley, who's the lead negotiator on the JCPOA, on the Iran nuclear deal, apparently a lot of Zionists and pro-Israel people seem to be against him. I mean, we know from the get-go that Netanyahu and such, they opposed the deal, but they seem to have a particular issue with Malley. Why is that the case?
Because when Robert Malley was inside of the Obama administration, he was a voice of reason when it came to not just Iran, he was a voice of reason when it came to the war in Syria and when it came to Libya. And basically, he was an obstacle to the like neoconservative designs for the Middle East, because not only did he have these viewpoints that he would then, in his advisory role to the president, express, but he also acted as somebody who connected the White House to back channels between these countries that the Israelis and the neocons in the U.S. want the U.S. to destroy. So that's why he also plays an important role, because his time working for the International Crisis Group, that's not, it's a non-governmental organization that has those contacts within these different governments that the U.S. doesn't talk to, which is why it makes him an important figure like that, you know what I mean? So this is why somebody like Robert Malley, he can make or break a war if he's able to bring, the right messages and right people to an administration that maybe wants to start one or has some people in it that wants to start one. And he did play that role during the Obama administration. There was, especially after the rise of ISIS in Syria, there was times when Robert Malley was able to connect, serve as like this intermediary between these back channels to de-escalate, the tensions between Syria and the U.S., which the U.S. started to change its positions to some degree after the rise of ISIS because they didn't want ISIS taking over the entire region. But neocons did. So it's also, I think, the attacks on Robert Malley are also the Israel lobby and, the neoconservative think tanks. And that kind of segment of the establishment, it's their way of putting a red line. It's like, if they fight something as small as just one advisor, it's kind of putting a line in the sand of, okay, then the Biden administration is going to be less likely to cross that later. So it's also just making themselves be heard and just trying to get in the way. They're desperate. They really don't want to return to the Iran nuclear deal. They want a war with Iran. And so this is also their way of trying to make sure that somebody who might be able to stop it isn't there.
In terms of Yemen, the Treasury Department, they issued a license and suspended sanctions for about 1 month. We also saw a last-minute arms sale to the UAE and Saudi Arabia was paused for review. Do you think there's some sort of rift in terms of support for Saudi Arabia, or is this just symbolism, just for show?
So far, I don't see anything beyond symbolism. And it's yet to be seen. Yemen is one place where there may be a change in policy, and I hope there is, because it would definitely prevent a lot of suffering if there were a change in policy in terms of overturning sanctions. As far as the U.S. relationship with the Emiratis and the Saudis, at the end of the day, it's actually quite normal for an incoming administration to pause any arms agreements that were made under a previous administration. That's not abnormal. That's not out of the ordinary. And, the U.S., I don't think the U.S. is going to change its entire relationship with these people in the Middle East. These are its allies. It's not going to change overnight. So I really think it's again, when it comes to Democrats, you get a lot of symbolism. I do think in the long term, you may see a deterioration in the relationship with the Saudis moving forward, because that's more because the U.S. is shifting away from the Middle East slowly. But it is shifting away from the Middle East being sort of the center of its foreign policy strategy making. The U.S. for the future is much more interested in great power competition with Russia and China, particularly China. Something like 2/3 of U.S. naval assets are actually in Asia and surrounding China.
Wow.
So, I don't think this is necessarily because a Democrat came into office. I think it has more to do with the fact that liberals, Democrats, they do empire better and they're more effective at it. And this already had started under Obama, and they're just kind of continuing the trajectory of U.S. foreign policy that existed at the end of the Obama administration that got slightly disrupted by Trump, but not really that much. And part of that is shifting away from the Middle East a little bit.
Biden is continuing Trump's policy stealing the oil in Syria. We're also seeing an uptick of attacks from Daesh, a double suicide bombing in Baghdad, and these bus ambushes in Syria. Do you think this is going to be used as some kind of excuse to keep troop deployments there or increase them maybe?
That's a great question. I think, I can't tell the future, but I think what's most likely is that those kinds of things will be used as justifications to keep the remaining troop presence that America has. The troop presence in Syria is accomplishing the goal of making sure that the Syrian government can't access its own oil. And the U.S. presence in Iraq is accomplishing the goal of basically acting as a barrier between Iraq and Syria. That's the whole purpose of that, is to keep these countries from connecting with each other. A continuation of what we saw happening under the Obama administration, which was more of a reliance on small special operations units and specialized groups of troops rather than large troop presences as our way of like doing empire now.
In the last month, unfortunately, the rest of the Middle East has continued to see destabilization and unrest. There has been an unusual uptick in attacks by Daesh. In December, we saw a horrific ambush take place in the Syrian desert near Palmyra, where dozens were killed. This was followed by another bus attack in Syria in January. In Baghdad, there was a double suicide bombing, which left over 30 dead and scores of wounded. And the latest in Iraq, 12 fighters from the Hashd al-Sha'bi, or PMF, were killed in another ambush by Daesh. Now, some speculate that the recent rise in attacks by Daesh could be used as another excuse by the United States to maintain its forever presence in the Middle East, occupying Syria's oil and occupying Iraq as a buffer with Iran. In many ways, much remains the same and business as usual. We've seen Israel continue its regular bombing of Syria absolutely unchecked, killing a family of four just the other day. Not a word of condemnation from the international community or the new administration. Within one day of Biden's inauguration, Syria's Sana news agency reported that a U.S. convoy of 40 trucks had entered Syria illegally through the Al-Walid border crossing with Iraq. These convoys have been a regular occurrence as Trump has been busy stealing the oil, which he shamelessly admitted.
We're keeping the oil. We have the oil. The oil is secure. We left troops behind only for the oil.
This was confirmed in late 2020 during a Senate hearing between Senator Lindsey Graham and former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that a U.S. corporation, Delta Crescent Energy, would be plundering Syria's oil in a deal with the Kurdish-led SDF. Bashar al-Jafari, Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations, sent a clear message to the UN Security Council